move these people somewhere in safe place. It's impossible, absolutely impossible. So we do what we do. They have no shops, they have no transport, they have no possibility to feed themselves. So we help them.
Tatiana fled Kiev to Donbass 2 years ago, fearing arrest for her outspoken criticism of the Ukrainian government.
Everybody here understands that it's United States made all this trash to weaken European economy, to crash European economy, to force European industry to move to United States. Everybody here understands it. But why not European people? Ordinary people, of course, because I am sure that European top elite understands it best of all. But they're too corrupt to tell about it to their peoples.
On our way to the next drop-off, we're stopped by Russian soldiers. They tell us not to carry on the same road. We get out of the car to assess our options. There is heavy fire nearby. That's the reality across much of Donbass. Back in the car, massive incoming close by, and we're left no choice but to drive fast. In this desolate post-apocalyptic wasteland, it's artillery doing most of the killing. At the next drop-off, this woman tells me her mother is dying on the other side of the front, so she can't be with her in her final days. She breaks down in tears, saying she wants both sides to negotiate a peace. With peace negotiations further away than ever, both Russia and NATO seem determined to end this war with brute force. For the civilians trapped along either side of the battle lines, survival is a daily chore. Many won't see the end of the war. Many won't see the end of this week. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
Celebrating January 26th, best known as Australia Day, has become increasingly controversial in recent years, with people holding rallies on this day to highlight the historical plight of Aboriginals. Many Indigenous Australians who traced their lineage on the continent back 50,000 years regard it as Invasion Day. Tens of thousands of protesters lined up in Sydney, while thousands more gathered in Melbourne, Canberra and other cities, saying the day marks the beginning of colonial oppression and genocide.
Nobody's got the right to celebrate genocide. That's it. This is ground zero, genocide. Ground zero happened here on 26th of January, 1788. Nobody should be celebrating. It's not an event to celebrate.
The government has designated January 26th as National Day, which marks the anniversary of the 1788 arrival of the first fleet of British ships in Port Jackson. But protesters believe the government is still trying to gloss over the scale of British colonizers' crimes against Native Australians.
I think most white Australians would not celebrate this day at all if they knew exactly that level of depression and deep sadness.
There are several accounts of how colonizers wiped out Indigenous communities in Australia through brutal and heart-wrenching repression. Emily Caroline Cray, a young settler traveling through northwest Queensland in 1883, recounts some of the British colonizers' horrendous crimes in her personal diary.
The station owner has 40 pairs of blacks' ears nailed around the walls collected during raiding parties after the loss of many cattle speared by the blacks.
Aboriginal people remain the most disadvantaged Australians, with higher rates of poverty, health issues and imprisonment than any other community. Now more than 2.5 centuries later, they're still struggling to find their feet in a white-dominated society. Australia's Prime Minister is planning to hold a referendum in March on recognizing around 4% Indigenous people in the Constitution. But repeated calls to abolish the controversial National Day have failed on deaf ear, as the government remains adamant to celebrate what many call the anniversary of Australia's colonization.
Due to a surge in respiratory infections, hospital emergency departments in many EU countries are currently being overwhelmed. Hundreds of drugs to treat winter-related illnesses are unavailable in most of the bloc's 27 nations. The crisis has been raised in the European Parliament.
We debate again about shortage of different medicines, most notably antibiotics. This debate is the proof that the European Commission is not the solution, but the cause of many problems all across Europe.
EU inflation is very high because of energy sanctions against Russia. The production of drugs in the bloc has slumped because of rising manufacturing costs associated with inflation. China is a major supplier, but relations between Brussels and Beijing have deteriorated.
We are witnessing public health systems across the EU become overwhelmed and exhausted as a result of the recent surge of COVID-19, flu, and RSV patients.
Critics say as a result of following US foreign policy, EU leaders have created a new health crisis by jeopardising global supply chains. A growing number of EU health workers are forced to stay at home after becoming ill themselves.
The workers in the field are not getting to work. They are perhaps at work and not being productive sufficiently or not contributing well. And that affects the economy at the same time.
Experts say standards in health services across the EU vary greatly. Statistics show a person in intensive care with COVID-19 in Luxembourg has a 65% chance of survival. In fellow EU nation Romania, it's just 25%. There are warnings the current health emergency could get even worse.
The COVID virus is still circulating within Europe, and I wanted to share with you that we're closely monitoring the situation in China and, of course, in the United States, where a new Omicron subvariant has appeared.
It was left to Russia to fly in emergency medical equipment to Italy when COVID-19 first struck Europe. It's the type of cooperation we are unlikely to see again anytime soon. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
For more than 120 years, the steelworks have dotted the Scunthorpe skyline. Its glory days when tens of thousands of people worked here are long gone. And these are anxious times for the 4,000 or so staff on shift and tens of thousands in the supply chain. British Steel is the UK's second largest steel manufacturer after India-owned Tata Group, ranking 25th worldwide and 8th in Europe. However, it's been troubled for decades. In 2019, the uncertainty over Brexit pushed it to bankruptcy. Since then, it's had three owners, most recently China's Jingye Group, which is asking the British government for hundreds of millions of dollars to go green and to keep its doors open.
A long tale to it, this story of the decline of the British steel industry. And you take it all the way back to after the Second World War, where there was a lack of real investment going in, and the result being not being very competitive, and other emerging nations, our very successful nations, like, for example, Korea and obviously China, now producing steel at a cheaper price, more efficiently, and the UK was left behind.
Soaring energy prices fueled by the UK-backed war in Ukraine, carbon taxes and lost markets are only some of the reasons that have added to the already tough trading conditions. The $370 million rescue package from the government is to help British Steel replace its energy-intensive coal-burning blast furnaces with electric alternatives. Only a short while after Number 10 gave the green light for a new coal mine near Scotland.
Sadly, we're going to be seeing over the next few years more contradictory issues when it comes to what's green, what's environmentally acceptable and what is not. And then put that against actually the practical issues about the difficulties in obtaining power, the cost of power, and a lot of that you could say put down to the war in Ukraine. But it's a global issue, this one, which is going to mean that politicians will be, I'm afraid, well, whether it's actually greenwash or pure green, is going to be interesting to see actually what comes out.
It also comes a few days after British Volt, a car battery gigafactory, touted as a Brexit success story, declared bankruptcy.
British Steel underpins essential sectors in the UK economy, from aerospace to transport to construction. And the unions, such as GMB, are saying that the government handout will do little for the long-term future of an industry that's lurching from one crisis to another. Site 4 is up, Scunthorpe.
Okay. Ukrainian officials took part in a meeting of EU foreign affairs ministers on Monday via video link. An additional €500 million military aid package for Kiev was confirmed, but the EU is at pains to point out that's just a drop in the ocean compared to what the bloc has already provided since last March.
Keep in mind the figure of €49 billion is the total amount of support to Ukraine, military, financial, economic and humanitarian.
Just a few days ago in the European Parliament, the strategy was condemned.
It's militarism that's driving a dramatic rise in geopolitical tensions, drastically undermining our security. And you'd think that the Ukraine war would have shocked us out of this approach, but no.
Workers have taken to the streets of Brussels to demand peace negotiations.
We need to stop this war because it's affecting our workers, and our workers have already been affected with prices because of the COVID situation.
EU foreign ministers adopted a fresh round of sanctions against Iran on Monday over alleged human rights abuses. The grounds for such sanctions are vehemently rejected by Tehran. Critics say the West's policy towards Russia and Iran is being driven by Washington. Moscow and Tehran control the largest energy reserves in the world. Analysts say the EU's access to these markets is being hampered due to influence from the United States, and ultimately it is ordinary citizens who are paying the price. Also on Monday, Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shtayyeh updated EU foreign ministers on the appalling situation in the occupied territories. There was absolutely no discussion on the EU side regarding possible sanctions against Israel. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The record-breaking inflation in the United Kingdom on the one hand and the multiple growth of interest rates and the increase in loan costs on the other hand are reducing the purchasing power of the British public day by day. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Daily Mirror has covered this story and tells us more. Business owners have been warned that thousands of firms face collapse this year as the cost of living crisis continues. According to insolvency firm Begbie's Traynor, last year the number of companies on the brink jumped by more than a third. They expect this number to rise this year due to higher costs and consumers cutting back on spending. Julie Palmer, a partner at the firm, says they have been receiving an increasing number of calls from business owners who are left concerned over whether they should carry on. The firm says the number of companies in critical financial distress jumped by 36% in the last 3 months of 2022. This is defined by if a company has more than £5,000 in country court judgments or a winding up petition against it. The number of country court judgments served against companies in 2022 jumped by 52% compared with 2021. Julie Palmer says that up until now, low interest rates and loans had helped firms, while COVID loans and longer time to pay taxes during the pandemic also provided support. However, she says there is nothing on the horizon in terms of what might replace them. A backlog in the insolvency courts due to COVID has delayed some company collapses. Julie Palmer said the courts were closed for business, so nobody could take recovery action against non-payers, and we are beginning to see those cases push through now. These challenges have already proved lethal for some business owners who admit that the pressures of keeping their businesses running feel like a never-ending nightmare. Britain recently cemented a new downgraded spot in the world's economic rankings after being overtaken by India. According to the Centre for Economics and Business Research, the United Kingdom dropped from 5th to 6th biggest economy earlier than expected and now won't move for 15 years. The consultancy's World Economic League table said, but it happened in 2021 instead. The annual report now expects the United Kingdom's position to remain stable at 6th place over the next 15 years. The report warns UK growth will no longer exceed that in the rest of Europe in the coming years. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered this story and tells us more. Business activity contracted at its fastest pace in 2 years in December as the high cost of living restricted household spending and companies cut investment, raising the prospect of a British recession. According to a closely watched survey, the services sector, which accounts for about three-quarters of private sector output, faced the biggest squeeze since the second COVID-19 lockdown. A slump in manufacturing output dating back to last August continued in January. Illustrating the effects of high energy prices, rising interest rates and falling consumer demand, business reported a sustained downturn in new orders that meant they were churning through backlogs of old orders to maintain staffing levels. The Standard & Poor's Global SIPs Flash Purchasing Managers Index, which includes 80% of the survey's responses from the services and manufacturing sectors, dropped below the level expected by city economists to 47.8 from 49 in December. A reading below 50 indicates activity has contracted. Chris Williamson, the chief business economist at Standard & Poor's Global Market Intelligence, said, industrial disputes, staff shortages, export losses and the rising cost of living and higher interest rates all meant that the rate of economic decline gathered pace again at the start of the year. Chris Williamson added, weaker than expected PMI numbers in January underscored the risk of the United Kingdom slipping into recession. Britain is expected by many economists to suffer a recession in the first half of 2023, before a modest recovery later on in the year. Inflation, which has stayed above 9% since last April, is forecast to fall back before the end of the year, taking the pressure off the Bank of England to keep raising its base rate much above the current 3.5%. Headline, annual inflation in the United Kingdom is currently 10.5%, well above the Bank of England's 2% target. British firms reported hiking their prices to pass on more than 18 months of rising raw materials and energy costs, with the addition of recent increases in staff wages. Chris Williamson said the overall rate of decline indicated also remains only modest, but this is undeniably a disappointing start to the year for the United Kingdom, reflecting not just short-term hits to growth, to economic growth, such as strike action and the rise in energy costs due to the Ukraine war, but also highlighting the ongoing damage to the economy from longer-term structural issues such as labour shortages and trade woes linked to Brexit. Russia Today has also covered this story and tells us more. According to the latest figures released by the Office for National Statistics, ONS, Household Finances Survey on Wednesday, 25th of January, Britain's poorest households are among the worst hit by the cost of living crisis, as living standards are struggling to keep up with inflation. The median disposable income for the poorest fifth of the population dropped 3.8% in the financial year through to March of 2022, while wages and benefit payments also failed to keep up with skyrocketing inflation. The data exposes how the squeeze is increasing inequality in the United Kingdom as an unbridgeable gap opens up between the highest and the lowest income households. It also shows the struggle to raise living standards since the nation voted to quit the European Union back in 2016, as Britain's slowing economy weighs on wages. The median household disposable income declined by 0.6% from the 2021 financial year, with worse expected to come as inflation topped four-decade highs last November. By the end of the period covered by the Office for National Statistics data, inflation had surged to 7%. Meanwhile, the richest fifth of the country enjoyed 1.6% growth versus a 3.8% drop for the worse-off and a 2.4% slump for the second-poorest fifth of the households. Since the Brexit vote, living standards in Britain have barely increased. The poorest fifth of the population have seen their median disposable income plunge from just above $20,000 in 2016-2017 to $17,900 in 2021-2022. By contrast, the richest fifth of the population have gone from $78,000 to $81,500. During the latest year, the increasing divide was driven by wages and salaries, which dropped 7.5% for the poorest households and grew by 7.8% for the richest. Meanwhile, a former Bank of England bigwig warned of more pain to come for millions of British households from rising mortgage costs. Andy Haldane, who was the bank's chief economist until 2021, predicted real wages would fall again this year because of the impact of punishingly high inflation. The Bank of England is forecast to hike its main interest rate from 3.5% to 4% next week to try to cool inflation, which has begun to ease. That will hit millions of borrowers in Britain with variable rate mortgages and those looking for new home loans.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Enmity of arrogant powers towards Iran originates from Leather's anti-arrogance and colonialist spirit. This is the part of a televised speech delivered on January 9, 2022, by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the anniversary of an uprising by the people of Qom on January 9, 1978.
The January 9th uprising was a brilliant combination of zeal and rationality. These events form our history, and we must learn from them. But a nation that is alive does not look only at the past. It also looks at the next step, to be taken and the horizons ahead in every stage of its history. In accordance with the developments of its time and in accordance with the duties that fall on that nation, we must identify the task to be done at the present moment. We must determine our steps for the future. And we must identify the horizon, fix our eyes on it, and move towards it with all our strength and power. In this way, the movement will be successful in the real sense of the word. In addition, it will achieve the final victory, which is first of all a pure life for the Iranian nation. If others learn from it, and if it becomes a model, this is another issue. But we should achieve prosperity and an Islamic lifestyle, which is a pure life that has worldly comforts, has both religion and welfare, and is good for both the body and the soul.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today. And that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
At the present time, we are in the middle of the path. Of course, part of the way has been travelled up until today. The Iranian nation has worked hard, and we have moved forward a little. But we should identify what our duty is today and what our duty and horizons are for the future as well. Sometimes one sees that they carry out polls. For example, they ask the opinion of the people. But these things do not show the truth of the Iranian nation. The truth of the Iranian nation is shown by the funeral of Martyr Soleimani. It is these things that show the mood of the Iranian nation and what their sentiments and feelings are. In other words, in order to understand the reality and feelings of this nation, a domain as great and vast as the country and people of Iran is needed. Therefore, the polls that some groups carry out here and there, some of which have ulterior motives behind them, and some of which are innocent, cannot be a criterion in this regard.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The death of seven Israelis at a synagogue at the hands of a Palestinian, and in less than 24 hours, another shooting incident resulting in the injury of two Israelis. These incidents may have come as a shock to many, but it falls pale to the number of Palestinians that have been killed at the hands of the Israeli regime. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at Israel's security failure, the rise of grassroots Palestinians against the Israeli regime, and whether this new cabinet can even last what appears to be a wave of Palestinian resistance, including Israel's internal crisis with its own people. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Fra Hughes, author and director of Palestine Aid Belfast, joins us from Belfast. Also joining us is Arnold August, author and journalist, who joins us from Montreal.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
All right, gentlemen, welcome to you. But Fra Hughes, first to you. So you have seven Israelis that were killed. 21 years old is the age of the person, of the Palestinian who did that. And then in less than 24 hours, you have another two that were injured in a shooting incident. This one was carried out by a 13-year-old. I'm mentioning the age because it's significant in the follow-up questions that I'm going to ask. What's your reaction to what has occurred, first of all?
Well, I think if we put things in context, that you've seen last year in 2022, 150 Palestinians were killed, murdered, summarily executed by the Israeli illegal occupation in the West Bank. And already in January and the first month of 2023, we have had up to 40 Palestinians summarily executed, along with many, many more injured. I think if you look back at the history of the occupation, which is illegal, if you look at the 1 million illegal Zionist Israeli Jewish settlers in the West Bank. This is in contravention of the Fourth Geneva Convention, which states that Israel, as an occupying force, illegally occupying force, should not move its civilian population into the occupied territories. Indeed, in 2002 in Jenin, you had this refugee camp filled with refugees from 1948, when Israel, the Israeli state, was born in bloodshed by terrorism, by many of the people who went on to become the leaders of Israel at that time, regarded by the British government as terrorists. In 2002, you had 52 people murdered in Jenin by the illegal Zionist occupation forces. So there is a history going back to 1948 and the Nakba. There's a history going back to 1967 and the illegal occupation of the West Bank, of the continued ethnic cleansing of Palestinians from their land and from their homes, while Israeli settlers build homes illegally on land that has been confiscated or stolen or illegally occupied by the settler movement. They have stolen water resources, they have stolen arable land, and they have occupied the homes of the indigenous population. So when we see heavily armed troops going into Jenin, a refugee camp, in order to summarily arrest and or execute people, you know, you're going to have resistance to this oppression. And Palestinians, under international law, can use any and all means of resistance against this illegal occupation. And with the new right-wing Israeli government heavily kind of indebted to the settler movement, right, and getting a lot of their votes and a lot of their political value from the settler movement, I'm not surprised settlers have faced the brunt of Palestinian resistance.
Yeah, point well taken. I mean, if you want to take a look at this, Arnold August, what our guest there said, obviously there's a history there of the way that Palestinians have been violated in so many words. I mean, from the deaths to the detainment to all the core issues that exist. I mean, we can go through, we can't because we don't have the time, but so many ways that they have been violated. So many are not shocked at what has happened. And that is one of the most interesting points, because even Israelis, in terms of the outpouring, if you want to gauge even social media, even though they regret what has happened, but they're not really that shocked as they should be, because Israel has violated Palestinian rights so much, especially with the most recent massacre that occurred in Jenin refugee camp. So wasn't this a natural occurrence, as the Palestinian resistance groups have said, to occur? And this being based on what happened in Jenin with that massacre of the 10 Palestinians?
Yeah, thank you for having me. And both what you said and what Fred just mentioned as well, I think we're pointing to a very important scenario or analysis, and that is the resistance in Palestine is developing, has been developing for some time. And I guess this is one of the reasons that Israel tries to intimidate the Palestinian resistance, for example, what they did in Jenin. And I would like to say we're not alone in thinking that. I'm a member of the Board of Trustees of the Global Gathering in support of the Palestinian resistance, and they just issue a very powerful statement only a few hours ago in which they say that this, they fully support the attack against the Israelis in Jerusalem, and is part of this wave of further development of Palestinian resistance using armed struggle. It is their only way. How else can Palestinians defend themselves if it is not for armed struggle? And I think that we are heading in that direction. And it's interesting that, as you mentioned, the reaction from the ground in Israel is not as powerful against this act by the Palestinians as it normally is. But I think it's one thing is clear, that Jerusalem is occupied by United States and Israel. And according to all laws and norms internationally, an occupied people have a right to resist. And this is what happened in Jerusalem yesterday. They had a right to resist. Of course, this is being, well, the United States, of course, their spokesman, Blinken, and others from the State Department, they didn't blink an eye. Sorry for the pun. They didn't blink an eye. They called it a terrorist organization, while at the same time saying, well, we don't have all the facts, what happened in Jerusalem yesterday. We know the facts. The main fact is that Israel, as an arm of the United States, has been carrying on this terrorist activity, as Fra just mentioned, for many years. We're talking about decades, and it is bound to erupt as it has in Jerusalem today, and who knows what will happen again. In fact, there was another attack only a few hours ago, so this is building up, and the armed resistance is building up. And the support of the Islamic Republic of Iran is very important to the morale and also armaments for the Palestinian resistance. This has to come to an end. We are in a stage where no one can turn a blind eye to the massacres, I would say genocide, ongoing genocide by the Israeli Zionist entity against the Palestinian people.
Okay. Well, I just checked before I asked, I was going to ask you this question, Fra Hughes, as to whether there was an outcome from the cabinet meeting that Netanyahu has held. So far, there's no news on that. And the reason why I'm bringing this topic up is because based on the source of an Israeli journalist and commentator who worked for Israel's Channel 13 News, he has said that the recommendations by Prime Minister Netanyahu will be for a law to deport families of terrorists, in reference to the Palestinians, immediate sealing of terrorist homes, arresting family members and friends, and then sending out reinforcements to the occupied West Bank. And then the last one, which we're going to get into later, approving more gun licenses to the civilian population of Israel. Now, that's really important, and I don't want to address have you address this now because I'm going to ask the question later. But it doesn't. It does not sound appropriate to the degree of violence that you would expect from this cabinet. It almost sounds like they're somewhat intimidated. The tone of what's being proposed is not that extreme, if I may use that word, unless that's a incorrect interpretation of what's being proposed. Because one would think that you would think things like let's go to the Palestinian homes and get rid of Palestinians, etc. But it doesn't have that type of a tone to it. Am I reading this correctly, first of all?
I'm not sure. I think it's a very extreme reaction. I know over the years it has been Israeli policy, or has been in the past, to knock down the homes of the people who are involved in the resistance and in resistance operations, and indeed to knock down maybe the homes either side or parallel to the home of the Palestinian resistance fighter. I mean, this is actually a punitive revenge and retribution upon the community. This is collective punishment against individual acts. I heard the father of the martyr yesterday, who was involved in the operation in Al-Quds, say that he was unaware that his son was perhaps a member of any paramilitary resistance organization. He stated that, everyone has a different view on the occupation and how to resist that, or how to kind of rebel against what the occupation is doing. So, these community kind of repercussions where you knock down the home of the family. Indeed, it's the first time I've heard of Israel threatening to deport the families. I mean, are they going to deport them to Jordan? Are they going to deport them to Gaza, which is more likely? This is a form of continued ethnic cleansing, a continuation of the Nakba. I mean, if you have an intifada, for example, in the West Bank, and you have tens of thousands of young men, teenage boys, engaged in throwing bricks and bottles at armoured vehicles that can do absolutely no damage to them. When you look at the nine people who were martyred in Jenin, the Israeli army was claiming that there was a gun battle. But no Israeli troops have been injured. So, I mean, where are the guns? Where are the weapons? Where is the video camera surveillance? Because drones were involved and missiles were involved. And I read that their initial raid, that they came in a refrigerated van, and a civilian van, surrounded a house and fired missiles at it. So this is the response of the Israeli offensive forces, is to surround, attack. And apparently there were four people found dead in that building once the Israeli forces withdrew.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
What do you think, Arnold August, about these recommendations that supposedly is going to be brought up in this cabinet meeting? Again, this is not confirmed yet. But I guess there, and rightly so, says that these are pretty severe and extreme, because some of the comments that I'm reading now on social media are actually pointing towards that, saying they're ethnic cleansing, just like our guest Frau Hughes there said. Because, for example, law for deporting families of terrorists, again, as Israel sees them, or immediate sealing of terrorist homes, or arresting family members and friends, these are all pretty severe, based on the viewpoint. Do you agree with that, that the steps taken are severe? Because it also points to the extinguishing the Palestinian existence off the land, in a sense.
Yes, it is a very serious set of situations, set of actions that the Israeli government is considering. But I think if they do that, it will backfire, because the Israelis know, whether they admit it or not, but the resistance, the armed resistance, for example, supported in a, to a large extent by Iran, and the resistance on the ground has been building up for several months now. And I like to, you know, the United States and Israel may be in for a surprise. I like to quote from the my board, in which I'm a member, and they say openly that the person who carried that out in Jerusalem, Kari Al-Kam, is a young Magdisi resistance fighter who was breastfeeded, with a Palestinian mother's milk. So here we go. While the while Israel is perhaps going to take some extreme action, the resistance, in my view, has never been stronger than it is now. And also the use of social media by the resistance. We often talk the social media used by United States or Israel, but the social media increasingly being used by the resistance is going to provide a further emphasis, a further impulse to the type of resistance that we're seeing, where the gathering, the group of gathering in Lebanon say openly, we have to use rifles, we have to use arms in order to overthrow the Zionist regime and head towards the liberation of Palestine. Uh-huh. So United States, they must be blustering, but there's the other side of the story as well. Increased development, the increased level of struggle based on any means necessary.
Well, this new phase, some have called it, Frau Hughes, whether you agree or not, is my question to you, where you have these sole individuals, Palestinians, that is, who are emerging and acting on their own, even though they're carrying out pretty sophisticated operation, like what has happened in the past two incidents in the past 24 hours. Now, on the one hand, you have them so young. I mean, we're looking at 21-year-old and a 13-year-old that have carried it out. But it's somewhat spelling a new resistance, isn't it, in terms of the operation being carried out by them, because they have no affiliations with typical resistance groups like Islamic Jihad or Hamas. And one example, good example, I guess, would be a group by the name of Den of Lions that was that emerged in August of 2022, where they acted against the Israeli regime. Are we looking at this being a more common place incidents of these Palestinians with no affiliations rising up on their own? And, of course, it's because they're being choked by the Israeli regime in terms of a variety of things that you're well aware of.
Well, I think one of the major dangers that you've just alluded to for the Israeli state and for the settler movement is that I'm sure there are many brave members of the resistance groups, but I'm sure there are many people who are the eyes and ears of the Israeli security forces, Shin Bet, etc., Mossad, within the West Bank, who do watch the resistance groups, do watch the resistance fighters, do watch the commanders, and do inform on the resistance groups within the West Bank. So if you're going to have individuals and young people with absolutely no affiliations and be seen to be clean operatives, it'll be very difficult to stop these attacks going forward. And there's maybe two things I'd like to say. One of them is, I think it was Golda Meir who said that the old will die and the young will forget. Well, a 21-year-old Palestinian in Al-Quds did not forget, and a 13-year-old boy who apparently his brother has already been martyred by the Israeli illegal occupation. So if you're going to kill 16-year-old boys, you may well find their 13-year-old siblings coming forward demanding a pound of flesh. And it reminds me in many respects of the suicide bombings that happened in and around, I would guess, 2002 with what happened in Jenin. If you keep crushing a people, if you keep destroying their homes, stealing their futures, giving them nightmares instead of dreams of a peaceful future, people have nothing else to react with except their own lives. And if they're willing to submit their lives, to make a point and to fight the oppressive illegal regime that oppresses them and represses them, I think that that's something that you'll see more of.
Well, taking a look at Israel right now as we speak, in terms of its occupying Palestine, the land of Palestine, there are protests that are happening, Arnold, August, and I mentioned that in the beginning in my question. You have Israelis that are out there protesting. Now, take a guess as to what they are protesting. Your options would be A, are they protesting how they're against this cabinet, taking laws in their own hand, wanting to reform what they call judiciary, which is under question in terms of it even being a judiciary, or B, it's because of what happened, which is one of the worst attacks. In the past 24 hours, you have 7 Israelis that were killed, some in serious condition, with another 2 in a span of 24 hours. Which do you think they're protesting?
Well, I didn't see the footage of that, and nor did I have a chance to read the report.
I'll tell you what they're protesting. They're protesting about those laws. To them, though there's 7 Israelis that were killed in less than 24 hours, that to them is not even a concern, because for them, their concern is how Netanyahu... Arnold August, are you with us? Okay, good. Netanyahu is trying to take laws into its own hands, to trying to decrease or trying to favor laws to its own favor, trying to... reform laws to his own favor. Now, my question is, you have that on the one hand, you have Palestinians, young Palestinians with no affiliations rising up, you have the resistance groups at the same time. These are pulling this new cabinet apart in different directions. What are the chances of it surviving this?
I think, thank you for quoting that, it makes it very clear. So the people in Israel, occupied Palestine, who are demonstrating against the government, even though it may not be very clear, but if they're against